When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Tonight's episode, The Slow Unraveling. The disappearance of Bryce Laspisa. Most disappearances have a clean edge, a moment you can point to, a last confirmed sighting, a door that closed, a phone that went to voicemail, a bed that wasn't slept in. The moment of absence is distinct enough that everything before it is the life, and everything after it is the mystery. That clean edge is what makes most missing persons' cases feel, at least structurally, like puzzles. There is a before, there is an after, and somewhere in the gap between them is the answer. The Bryce Laspisa case does not have a clean edge. It has something much harder to hold. It has a dissolution. A visible, documented, hours-long process of a person moving away from the version of themselves that everyone around them recognized. Not in a single dramatic moment, not in one catastrophic event, but in a slow, deliberate, almost methodical series of choices and non-choices that accumulated over the course of a day and a night into something that ended in the dark off a California highway. This is not a case about a sudden vanishing. It is a case about what precedes one. About what it looks like when someone starts to slip before they're ever officially gone. About the question that haunts everyone who knew Bryce Laspisa, and everyone who has followed the case since. What was happening inside him in those hours? And whether whatever it was could have been stopped. Bryce Laspisa was 19 years old in the summer of 2013. He was a student at Sierra College in Rocklin, California, in the greater Sacramento area. By the accounts of people who knew him, his parents, Karen and Mike, his friends, the people who had been around him through his first year away from home, he was, until a certain point in the summer before his sophomore year, a normal young man. Not perfect, not without the ordinary stresses of a college student trying to figure out who he was and what he wanted, but recognizably himself, recognizably present. The kind of person whose behavior followed the predictable contours of someone navigating early adulthood without anything that qualified as crisis. By most measures, the first year had gone reasonably well. He had found his footing. He had made connections. He had been doing what 19-year-olds do when they leave home for the first time, experimenting with the freedom of it, learning the difference between the life they were given and the one they might build for themselves, accumulating the specific experiences that early adulthood is made of. Nothing in that picture, for most of his first year, looked alarming. Then, in August of 2013, something changed. It didn't announce itself loudly. It arrived the way certain changes do, in the peripheral vision of the people closest to him. His parents noticed it in his voice. His friends noticed it in his behavior. Something that was hard to name precisely, but impossible to fully dismiss. A flatness where there had been energy. A distance where there had been presence. A quality of detachment that didn't match anything in Bryce's history and didn't have an obvious explanation that anyone around him could identify. He had been drinking more than usual. He had been sleeping in patterns that suggested something was disrupting his ordinary rest. He had been mixing alcohol with prescription medication in a combination that, over time, can produce effects on cognition, an effect that are difficult to distinguish from the outside from deliberate behavioral change. And he had begun giving things away. Not in the dramatic, conspicuous way that sometimes precedes a crisis. In the quiet way. A meaningful object passed along to a friend without much ceremony. Something personal offered without explanation. The kind of generosity that looks like generosity until it is placed alongside everything else and takes on a different character entirely. Whether that combination of behaviors was the cause of what followed, or whether it was a symptom of something that was already in motion, is a question the case has never fully answered. What the record shows is that by the time Bryce got into his car on August 29th, 2013, and began driving south from Rocklin toward his parents' home in Laguna Niguel in Orange County, something was already significantly wrong. His mother Karen had spoken to him earlier that day. She had noticed enough in that call to feel a specific kind of parental alarm. Not the ordinary worry of a mother whose son is driving a long stretch of California highway late at night. Something sharper. Something that told her the voice on the other end of the line was not entirely the voice she knew. She stayed on the phone with him. She kept the line open. She tracked his progress through the conversation, asking questions, trying to gauge where he was, trying to hold him in the connection, the way you try to hold someone who seems like they might be drifting. And what she tracked over those hours was not progress toward home. It was stasis. It was a young man sitting in a car in the dark on the side of a California highway, not moving, barely talking, present in the most minimal technical sense of that word. The drive from Rocklin to Laguna Niguel is approximately 6 hours under normal conditions. A long stretch of California Highway, Interstate 5, running south through the Central Valley and into Los Angeles County. The kind of drive that is tedious and manageable and done regularly by students making the trip between school and home. Bryce had made versions of this drive before. It was not unfamiliar. It was not, under normal circumstances, a journey that would produce anything worth noting. These were not normal circumstances. Bryce had been on the road for far longer than 6 hours without coming anywhere close to his destination. He had stopped somewhere along Interstate 5 in the Castaic area and had simply ceased to move forward. Not because of mechanical failure, not because of traffic, because somewhere in the course of that drive, whatever was propelling him forward had given out. In the course of the night, a California Highway Patrol officer made contact with him, checked on him, found him sitting in a parked car on the side of the road. Coherent, calm, able to indicate that he was fine and that nothing was wrong. Not impaired in any way that the officer could confirm through the ordinary channels of a roadside welfare check. The officer had no legal grounds for further intervention. A person is allowed to pull over and sit. A person is allowed to say they're fine even when they are not, and unless the visible evidence contradicts the words, there is a limit to what law enforcement can do. He left. And Bryce stayed. Not for minutes, for hours. Karen stayed on the phone. She kept the line open the way you keep a hand extended toward someone standing too close to an edge. Not grabbing, not pulling, just present. A voice in the dark that said, "I'm still here. Keep talking. Come toward me." At one point in those hours, Bryce told his mother he loved her. The way he said it was not the way you say it at the end of a call when you're on your way home and will see the person soon. It was heavier than that. More deliberate. Something that carried a weight that ordinary affection doesn't explain. Karen would describe it later as something that felt like a different kind of statement. Something that felt less like a greeting toward reunion, and more like the specific kind of declaration that people make when they are not certain there will be another opportunity. She heard it. She registered it. And she stayed on the line. A roadside assistance worker also made contact with Bryce during those stationary hours. Checked on him. Got the same answer. Fine. Everything's fine. Nothing to worry about. And then, sometime after 2 in the morning, Bryce began driving again. His parents, who had been awake through all of it, tracking him, calling, trying to understand what was happening, felt something close to relief. He was moving. He was heading home. Whatever had stalled him seemed to have passed. It had not passed. At approximately 2:20 in the morning on August 30th, 2013, Bryce's car, a black Toyota Camry, left the northbound side of Lake Hughes Road near Castec and went down an embankment. The car crashed. It came to rest in a ravine off the road. And when emergency personnel arrived at the scene, the car was there. His wallet was there. His phone was there. His belongings were there. Bryce was not. The scene that emergency personnel found at the bottom of that embankment on Lake Hughes Road was one that resisted easy interpretation. The car had gone off the road. That much was clear. But the nature of the impact was not consistent with a conventional accident. The damage was not consistent with a vehicle that had lost control at speed and struck something at high velocity. It was more consistent with a vehicle that had been driven off the edge of the embankment at relatively low speed, as if the driver had steered into the descent rather than been carried into it by inertia or mechanical failure. A controlled entry into an uncontrolled situation. Or depending on how you read the evidence, a deliberate movement. The car sustained damage. It was not destroyed. A person could have survived that impact and walked away from it. There was no blood at the scene, in quantities that would indicate serious injury. There was no indication of physical trauma that would have prevented Bryce from moving under his own power. His belongings, wallet, phone, the things a person typically keeps on them because they intend to continue existing in a world that requires identification and communication, were left behind. Not scattered in the crash. Left. Placed. Or simply not taken. In a car at the bottom of a ravine, off a road in the dark, in the early hours of a California morning, by someone who, the physical evidence suggests, walked away from that car on 2 functional legs, into terrain, into darkness, and was never seen again. The search that followed was extensive by the standards of a missing person's response. The terrain around Castec and Lake Hughes Road is not the kind of terrain that gives up its secrets easily. It is rugged, brushy hill country, the kind of landscape where someone moving through it in the dark without a clear destination could cover significant ground in any number of directions, without leaving a trail that search teams could follow to a conclusion. Helicopters swept the area. Search and rescue personnel worked the ground on foot. Dogs were deployed and followed what sense they could find into terrain that became increasingly difficult. Aerial searches were conducted over multiple days. Volunteers joined organized searches in the weeks that followed, with family members present, covering as much of the surrounding area as coordinated search efforts could manage. the family maintained a presence and an advocacy in the case that has never diminished. And the search produced what too many searches in cases like this produce: the confirmation that Bryce was not in the places that were searched, not a confirmation of where he was, no remains, no clothing, no equipment, no physical trace that provided a direction or a terminus. Just the car at the bottom of the embankment, and the absence of the person who had been driving it. Now let's examine the hours before the crash more carefully, because in the Bryce Laspisa case, those hours are not a gap in the record. They are the record. They are documented in unusual detail, through phone calls, through the contacts he had with law enforcement and roadside assistance, through the accounts of his parents, who were on the line with him through much of it. And what that record shows is something that, once you look at it clearly, is deeply difficult to classify. Bryce was not panicking. He was not behaving in the way that a person in the grip of an acute psychiatric crisis typically presents, with agitation, with incoherence, with the kind of visible distress that triggers intervention from the people around them. He was flat, quiet, distant, responsive when directly addressed, able to tell a highway patrol officer that he was fine in a way the officer accepted, able to tell a roadside worker that nothing was wrong in a way the worker accepted, and yet clearly, on some level, visible to his mother across a phone line and to the people who knew him well, not fine at all. This specific quality, the ability to pass as functional in brief external interactions, while something internal is in a state of profound disruption, is one of the most difficult presentations to identify and respond to in real time. Psychiatrists and crisis counselors who work with suicidal individuals describe a version of this repeatedly. The person who presents as calm, who answers questions accurately, who does not trigger the thresholds that normally prompt more aggressive intervention, who is, from the outside, simply a person sitting in a car, while from the inside, they have already made a decision that the people around them cannot see. It is not the absence of distress. It is the containment of distress in a way that makes it invisible to anyone who doesn't know the person well enough to recognize the gap between the surface and what lies beneath it. Karen Laspisa knew that gap was there. She could hear it across the line. She tried to bridge it. She kept him talking. She kept herself present. She did everything available to her from the end of a phone line, with hundreds of miles between her and her son. In the weeks and months leading up to the drive, there had been signs. They are the kind of signs that are visible in retrospect, with a clarity that is almost cruel in contrast to how ambiguous they appeared at the time. He had been giving things away, not in the dramatic, conspicuous way that sometimes precedes a crisis and is immediately recognized as a warning, in the quiet way. A meaningful object passed along to a friend. Something personal offered without ceremony. The kind of generosity that looks like generosity until it is placed alongside everything else and takes on a different character entirely. He had been sleeping irregularly. He had been withdrawing in increments. He had been combining alcohol with prescription medication in a way that, over an extended period, can produce dissociative effects, a gradual erosion of the felt connection between a person and their ordinary sense of themselves and their circumstances. Whether Bryce was in a state of substance-related impairment during those final hours, whether he was experiencing a psychological break that had been building for weeks before the night of the drive, or whether he was in a state that combined elements of both, these questions haven't been definitively answered. What can be said is this: the behavior documented in those final hours is consistent with a person who had, in some significant way, already separated from the life he had been living, who was present in the most minimal physical sense, while being, in some other, more essential sense, already somewhere else. And the direction he was moving, in all those hours of stillness, and then in the final movement off the road, was away. The giving away of possessions deserves its own consideration, because it is one of the behavioral markers that, in retrospect, speaks most clearly. When a person begins distributing meaningful objects, not casually, not incidentally, but in a way that has the quality of final disposition, it is one of the recognized warning signs of suicidal ideation. Not a guarantee, not a confirmation by itself. A signal. One that, in isolation, can be explained away as generosity, as simplifying, as the ordinary redistribution of objects that happens when a young person is between living situations. One that, placed alongside everything else Bryce was exhibiting in those weeks, the withdrawal, the disrupted sleep, the increasing flatness that his parents noticed in his voice, the substance use that was outside the normal range, forms part of a picture that the people who loved him were not yet seeing as a complete picture, because they were living inside it in real time. Without the perspective that distance and aftermath provide, without the ability to arrange the individual pieces into the shape they were building toward, seeing a son who sometimes seemed off, a friend who seemed more tired than usual, a person going through something that had not yet found its name, not yet seeing someone who was, piece by piece, putting things in order. There is a particular cruelty in the retrospective clarity of warning signs. Once you know the outcome, the signals arrange themselves into a sequence that feels nearly inevitable. But they didn't feel inevitable from inside the relationship. They felt like variations on ordinary. Like a young man having a hard couple of weeks. Like someone who would be fine once he got home. Once he slept. Once whatever pressure he was under eased. And the people who loved him held that frame. The frame of this is hard but temporary. Because the alternative frame, the one that assembled the pieces into something urgent and irreversible, was one that human beings naturally resist inhabiting about someone they love until there is no longer any choice. That resistance is not failure. It is the specific mercy and the specific tragedy of loving someone. The mercy that allows you to remain in the relationship rather than treating the person as a collection of warning signs. The tragedy that it can mean the warning signs are not assembled into their true meaning until it is too late to act on them. Copy. There are several theories about what happened to Bryce Laspissa after he walked away from that car, and they exist on a spectrum that ranges from the structurally simplest to the most difficult to hold. The first is that Bryce did not survive the night. That whatever state he was in when he left that vehicle, physically intact, but psychologically somewhere the rest of the world could not follow, led him into terrain, or into a body of water, or into some other circumstance in the dark around Castaic that ended his life. That his remains are somewhere in that landscape, in a location the searchers did not reach. The terrain around Lake Hughes Road is rough enough, and the circumstances were dark enough, and the window before searchers arrived was wide enough, that this is not only possible, but considered by many who have followed the case to be among the most likely explanations. It is also the explanation that offers the least to Bryce's family in the way of resolution. Because without remains, without a location, without physical confirmation, the case remains suspended. The family cannot grieve with the completeness that confirmed knowledge provides. They are left in the specific, formless limbo of not knowing, which is, as we have discussed in other episodes, a particular kind of sustained suffering that has no clean boundary and no definitive end. The second theory is that Bryce walked away and survived. That he made a decision, conscious or not, planned or arrived at in those final hours, to step out of his life. To disappear by choice rather than by catastrophe. That somewhere in the United States, or beyond it, Bryce LaSpisa is alive. Living under a different name, in a different context, having left behind the person he was, without leaving behind the capacity to be a person at all. Voluntary disappearances happen. They are rarer than the cases that produce them might suggest, but they happen. And the specific quality of Bryce's final hours, the deliberateness of it, the apparent decision-making involved in each pause and each movement, the leaving of possessions in a way that suggested intent rather than accident, is consistent with someone making a series of choices that culminate in the final one. The choice to stop, to not go back, to let the version of himself that everyone knew become a missing persons case while he moved forward into something no one could see. This theory offers a different kind of pain to his family. Not the finality of death, but the specific wound of having been left. Of the person you love, having looked at the life you built together and chosen to walk away from it in the dark without explanation or farewell. Of waiting, not for confirmation of what happened, but for a person who may have decided you wouldn't hear from him again. Karen and Mike LaSpisa have maintained a public presence in this case that reflects a family unwilling to let either theory foreclose the other. They have not accepted death without confirmation. They have not accepted voluntary disappearance without evidence. They have continued to search, to speak, to keep Bryce's name in the conversation, to hold the case open against the tendency of unresolved missing persons cases to fade from public attention as the months become years. Their advocacy is a form of refusing to let either absence win, refusing to let the not knowing become an ending by default. Now let's talk about what the case reveals beyond its own specific details, because the Bryce LaSpisa case is, among other things, a case about the particular difficulty of recognizing a crisis in someone you love before it becomes something irreversible. The signs were there. In retrospect, they are visible with the kind of painful clarity that retrospect always provides. The giving away of objects, the withdrawal, the disrupted sleep, the flatness in his voice that Karen heard across the phone line, the hours of stillness on the side of a highway that spoke of someone who had arrived at the end of his forward momentum and simply stopped. But these signs were visible in retrospect, partly because they are being assembled from a position that knows what they were building toward. In real time, inside the relationship, inside the ordinary flow of daily contact with a person you love, these signs are harder to assemble. Each one, in isolation, has an innocent explanation. He gave something away, because he was being generous. He seems quieter than usual, because he's tired, because school is stressful, because he's 19 and navigating things he doesn't fully know how to talk about yet. He's driving slowly, because he's being careful on a long night drive. The individual pieces do not automatically arrange themselves into a warning picture. It takes either a specific kind of training to recognize the pattern or a level of proximity and knowledge of the person that allows the cumulative weight of the signals to register as something more than the sum of its parts. Karen heard something in that phone call that told her something was wrong. She acted on it. She stayed on the line. She kept the connection open for hours, and it still wasn't enough. Not because she didn't try, but because the gap between what a parent can do across a phone line and what a person in the state Bryce appeared to be in actually needs is larger than any phone call can bridge. The thing that Bryce needed in those hours was physical presence. Someone in the car with him. Someone who could see him and not just hear him. Someone who could notice the things that a voice cannot carry. The expression on his face, the quality of his stillness, the specific way a person looks when they are not simply tired or distracted, but somewhere else entirely. Proximity is irreplaceable. It is one of the things that no amount of technology fully substitutes for. And the geography of that night, hundreds of miles of California highway between Bryce and the people who loved him, meant that proximity was exactly what was unavailable. There is something about this case that reflects a broader truth about mental health crisis and the limits of what the people closest to someone can see and do and stop. We live in a moment where the conversation about mental health is more open than it has ever been. Where the language exists more than it once did to name what was happening to Bryce. Where the resources exist, in theory, to interrupt the kind of trajectory his final weeks and hours describe. And yet the gap between the existence of that language and those resources and the moment when they reach the person who needs them in time is still, in too many cases, unbridgeable. Because crisis does not announce itself loudly enough. Because the people experiencing it often present the most composed face to the people most likely to help. Because the mechanics of getting help require a degree of initiative from the person in crisis that the state of being in crisis often removes. Bryce told a highway patrol officer he was fine. He told a roadside worker he was fine. He told his mother, across hours of phone call, that he was okay. He was not okay. And the version of not okay that he was experiencing was not visible enough from the outside to trigger the kind of intervention that might have changed what happened. That is not a criticism of the officer, or the worker, or Karen. It is a description of the specific difficulty of this kind of crisis, the one that is most dangerous precisely because it is least visible. The one that hides inside ordinary behavior just well enough to pass, until it doesn't need to anymore. Bryce Laspisa was 19 years old. He had people who loved him with the specific, irreplaceable intensity that parents bring to a child they have known from the beginning. He had a future that had not yet taken its full shape, which is the particular quality of 19 that makes its loss so specific. Not a life cut short at its peak. A life that had not yet reached the point where anyone could see what it was going to be. Whatever happened in the dark, off Lake Hughes Road on the morning of August 30th, 2013, whether Bryce's story ended there, or whether it continued somewhere beyond the reach of everyone who was looking for him. The version of him that existed before those final hours deserved more time. More time to figure out what was pulling him toward that embankment. More time to let the people who loved him get close enough to stop it. More time to find whatever was on the other side of whatever he was going through. That time was not available, and the absence of it The specific, irreversible absence of what might have been is what sits at the center of this case and refuses to move. Not all disappearances happen in an instant. Some happen slowly, one decision at a time, 1 mile at a time, 1 hour of stillness at a time, until the person you were looking for is somewhere the search can't reach. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and the most important thing you can do for the people you love is not wait for them to ask for help. Sometimes the ones who are slipping furthest are the ones who say they're fine.